And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. It's hard to believe, but it's 6 years since I last saw my guest today. In February 2015, she was a guest on my show. And in those days, she was New Zealand's permanent representative to the United Nations and international organizations in Geneva, and the Prime Minister's New Zealand's special envoy to Francophone Africa, and then she went on to become co-chair of the Security Council's, one of the Security Council's bodies on Syria. She was someone whose personality won people over and charmed so many of us who met her that she commanded the attention and respect of diplomats, business people, all sorts of people who came into contact with her. I observed firsthand the effect she had on people myself. I'm talking about Amanda Ellis, Ambassador Amanda Ellis. Welcome back to the McKay Interview, Amanda, and welcome back to Geneva.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's wonderful to see you. And it's been great to stay in touch with you over the years, too. And I'm a big fan of your program, as you know.
Oh, flattery will get you anywhere, Amanda. But it's good to see you. What have you been doing since we last saw each other? And what on earth are you doing in Geneva?
Let me start with what I'm doing in Geneva now. I'm thrilled to be here with the 23rd Global Summit of the International Leadership Association. I am honored to be the co-chair with Swiss Ambassador Thomas Greminger, who runs the Geneva Center for Security Policy. And the two of us were honored to open the conference today. We have just had a brilliant plenary panel with the head of UNOG, Tatiana Volovaya, who's just back from Moscow, the head of the IFRC. So interesting to see the kind of leadership in international Geneva.
Now, for those listening who don't know what UNOG means, if you're not in Geneva, it's the United Nations office at Geneva, the second biggest in the world after New York.
And I am being very bad, given that I'm always lecturing others about UN alphabet soup. So thank you, Michael, for pulling me up on that. But I think the conference theme, reimagining leadership together, is such a pertinent one at a time when we have the UN Secretary General calling Code Red for humanity, and one of my particular heroes, or heroines, Sylvia Earle, the oceans icon, pointing out that this decade is the most decisive in the next 10,000. So we're really here in international Geneva at a critical juncture in global history, global her story as well.
And you know, and you don't feel that this Code Red and red flag flying, all that is a little bit over the top?
When you read the latest report of the IPCC and International Panel on Climate Change, where hundreds of the world's most eminent scientists have come together and said conclusively that the climate crisis is being caused by human activity, and we have an opportunity, we still have a window to fix things, but we need to reduce emissions 7% a year between now and 2030. And with the global pandemic, I think it's really thrown into stark relief two key concepts that we all understand now more viscerally. One is interconnectedness. We know that I'm not safe if you're not safe. We know that we really live in a global village. But the second one is exponentiality. And I think that is a little harder for many of us to understand.
And say that word again for those who are not mathematicians.
Exponentiality. Absolutely. So, for example, it took 3 months for the first 1 million cases of COVID. We now have half a day, another million cases. Yeah. Same thing with the climate crisis. So when I look at the scientists, the brilliant scientists with whom I now work, and see the hockey stick in the graph from the 1980s, when carbon in the atmosphere continued to accumulate at such a rapid exponential rate that we are now rapidly warming. So we're at 1.2 degrees already. And you'll recall that back in 2015, which was such a watershed year for the international community, the Paris Agreement was we really wanted to avoid 1.5. We are already at 1.2. And many of the scientists I work with say we've already overshot. We're on a trajectory now where we have to be so careful, not only about increasing emissions, but actually now looking to draw down.
Okay, we're going to come back to that in our conversation, Amanda, but the reason you're here is because of this international leadership conference. You were for many years a top diplomat, as I said, with one of the world's great democracies. And you told me once that New Zealand was a founder member of the United Nations in 1945. I hadn't realized that. What are the critical components, in your opinion, of effective leadership, at least in liberal democracies? And I just ask you the question, really, if you could touch on this, do we need to include dictatorships, one-party states and oligarchies? Maybe we should even include them, though leadership there is driven by coercion and violence, or at least a threat of violence. History teaches us that for people to exercise their choice under such regimes, the result is often violent overthrow rather than change through the ballot box. But what are the critical components of effective leadership in your experience?
This is such a great question. And I'm actually going to use a story about Jacinda Ardern, who is our current New Zealand Prime Minister and who was returned with a full majority, first time since we introduced the mixed member proportional system in New Zealand, which gives you an idea of the marks that the average New Zealander gave Jacinda at the ballot box. And I think when you look at the way in which she handled the COVID pandemic, it was really emblematic of the kind of leadership traits we really need for effectiveness. First of all, she listened to the scientists. And you mentioned authoritarian leadership. And we saw quite a stark contrast between those leaders of democracies and those who were authoritarian strongmen, or who behaved like authoritarian strongmen even in liberal democracies. And we saw how much less successful that approach was. So I truly believe that a collaborative approach to leadership that takes into account the science, listens to the science, and acts on it, and then is compassionate. COVID was not easy for anybody and is still not easy. But right at the very beginning of the pandemic, there was so much anxiety and uncertainty. And Jacinda taking to social media every day and providing an update directly to citizens around what was happening.
That's what she
did. Yes, yeah. Every day. And I had a call from my elderly mother at the time, and she said, "I hate this lockdown. I hate being at home." But she said, "Jacinda's such an effective communicator. I know why I have to be at home. I need to be at home to save lives. And so I'm doing it."
I think I met your mother.
Oh, you
on one
did.
Occasion.
Yes.
I remember you were both your parents.
Absolutely, yes. So that to me is really embodies the kind of leadership we need. Compassionate, collaborative, cooperative, and courageous. And this art of good communication. And as you know, Michael, I have a particular interest in women's empowerment and SDG 5, Sustainable Development Goal 5, on gender equality. And what was fascinating to me was that even though women leaders constitute only 11% of country leaders,
political leaders, we're talking
political
about
leaders,
politics, yeah.
Yes, they were responsible for over 40% of the successful early responses to COVID. And those qualities that I just outlined of effective leadership were common among them. So it is very interesting to me to see there is a strong argument for why we need more women represented not only as leaders of countries, but in boardrooms and in legislatures too.
Now, it's a big question, and I just wondered if you can give me a fairly succinct answer, because we've got lots of other things to talk about. Is democracy and freedom, or are democracy and freedom in your opinion under threat, or at least in decline, or are you an optimist by nature?
I'm always an optimist by nature, but I must say I was terribly shaken by what happened in the US on January the 6th, as I think were many people.
Many of us were, yeah. My guest today is Amanda Ellis of the Arizona State University, Julie Ann Wrigley Global Futures Laboratory, and a former New Zealand ambassador and permanent representative to the United Nations here in Geneva. Amanda, let's talk about sustainability. I know that it's a topic very close to your heart. In the context of what you have been doing for the past few years since we last met, now, I wouldn't regard myself as a cynic, but I do have my doubts. Maybe I'm a skeptic. Are we really, Amanda, in an existential crisis? I know you said what you said just a few minutes ago, but regarding sustainability and climate change, or are there other, I just put this to you, Amanda, are there other perhaps big forces at work which, for example, might have big financial incentives to behave in the way that pushes their own agenda? And I ask the question almost 2 years ago. I had Professor Tim Palmer from Oxford University on my show. He's a mathematical physicist and was much more, he was much more nuanced and cautious about a likely climate Armageddon, the world driving off the cliff edge, as I put it to him at the time, that many activists think and others nowadays proclaim. But what do you think about that? I mean, am I being too extreme?
Yeah, well, Tim Palmer's work in climate physics at Oxford is very interesting. And he is very concerned that we need better modelling because the impact of the climate crisis is to have more intense weather events. But I think when you look at the evidence over the last couple of years, Michael, and you see the worst wildfires ever in history in California, you see wildfires in the Arctic, you see unprecedented flooding, and we see sea level rise. I live in Hawaii, and we have sandbags in Waikiki. We've already got documented sea level rise. And for island states in particular, this is not just an existential crisis. It's a crisis that is happening now. You also look at the superstorms, and you look at the number of intense and extreme weather events that happened last year. You look at the 1.5 billion animals that were killed in the fires in Australia. So it really is, I think, very evident now to the average person. And I was very guilty back in 2015 when we were negotiating the Sustainable Development Goals of not seeing climate as the imminent existential crisis it was. I did not understand the science. Now I work with two amazing scientists, Peter Schlosser, who is one of the world's most famous earth scientists, and Johan Rockström, who leads the Potsdam Institute. And Peter is our vice president and vice provost at the new Julianne Wrigley Global Futures Laboratory. And they look at both planetary boundaries and societal boundaries. And when we look, we're in what they call the buffer zone. We're no longer in a safe operating space for humanity. And scientists like Tim, who you referenced, are no longer able to figure out the modeling. We just don't know anymore what is going to happen as we continue to experiment. And as an economist too, I look back at the Brundtland Commission and I look at the definition of sustainability that Gro Harlem Brundtland came up with, and then looking at the Rio summit. So the definition of sustainability was that we should not behave in a way that is to the detriment of future generations. And unfortunately, we have done that. And the brilliant visionary I work with, Julianne Wrigley, who was a co-founder of the world's first global institute of sustainability and the first college and school of sustainability, really last year said sustainability is no longer enough. We actually need to be looking at regenerative and just global futures. We need to be looking at both the planetary and the societal implications. And really now for me, I look at the 5.9 trillion, trillion with a T, that the IMF estimates are spent in fossil fuel subsidies, and that's 2020 data. And I look at what it would cost for a just transition, which is way less. And the point that you just asked about in your question, are there forces that play that have a vested interest in there not being change, or in the lay people like you and I, Michael, not fully understanding the potential for the climate crisis to disrupt everything? And I think you're right. There are special interests who don't want us transitioning. We need to keep fossil fuels in the ground. In fact, 80% of the known fossil reserves need to be kept in the ground because burning of fossil fuels is 73% of the emissions creating global warming.
So, simple question from my benefit and a plea for ordinary people listening, ordinary people, not activists, not high-flown academics, where can you find dispassionate and disinterested information about what's really going on in these issues of climate, whether or not man has the means, let alone the will, to fix or at least restore some balance, some equilibrium? Yeah, where?
Great question. So
where do you go
for that? The first place to go would be the summary for policymakers of the IPCC, of the International Panel on Climate Change.
Yeah.
And that would be the first place. Then there are many great works, NGOs, non-government organisations, and universities put out. So, for example, we work closely with Conservation International and with the Nature Conservancy. So they're trusted brands. We know they're not pushing anything. They're not trying to sell us a product. But those are good places to go for basic climate information in a way that you and I can understand. And knowing that, in fact, the reason we talk about this decade as the most decisive decade is because carbon stays in the atmosphere for such a long time. And think of it like a blanket. And we keep putting more and more blankets on, and then we start to sweat. And there are implications of global warming that manifest themselves in these extreme weather events.
Okay, and even more, and another plea for ordinary people like me, what can ordinary people do to make a difference? I mean, what can be done that does not, this is the key, that does not hit the poorest disproportionately? Because it's quite easy for the middle class, the well-heeled, the billionaireses, the leader living and say, oh, I'll pay more tax or I'll do more of this. But that's a tiny percentage of the population. Ordinary men and women pay tax, and that's what governments live from. I mean, you know that because you're working in government. Yeah?
The great news is that the path to sustainability and to regenerative futures is no longer a path to sacrifice. Renewables now are much cheaper than fossil fuels like oil and gas and coal. So that is the really fantastic news. The bad news is that because of the fossil fuel subsidies, we are not making the transition fast enough. So really it's a question of political will. We should not be, as Greta Thunberg says, sitting around blah, 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 all talk and no action. We need to get rid of the fossil fuel subsidies immediately, so that the renewable solutions are, in fact, able to be used much, much faster. Now, it is true that the last 20% is going to be hard because there needs to be an entire systems change. But we know that solar, renewable, these are things that the ordinary citizen can do. So I arrived in Hawaii, like you, a bit of a climate despondent. And as I began to work with Julie and others, I realized, oh, wow, yes, I can have solar panels on the house and I can have a solar powered car. I can have an electric car. I can make sure that I separate my waste, as you all do very nicely in Switzerland, so that my scraps, food scraps, don't go to landfill and create methane. So a lot of this is just about basic education, which starts in schools and universities. And there are these very obvious things that we can do. Can we walk? Can we bike? Which is better for our physical health than taking a fossil fuel-powered car. And we're seeing now cities through the C40 initiative, which is now some 700 cities, who are now transferring to electric-powered buses, for example, or green hydrogen transport. And that to me is very exciting. We do need systems change. And the good news is that if we get the incentives right and we do get rid of subsidies, then we are able to have just transitions and to make sure that, as you say, those who are the poorest are able to also benefit.
Now, Mandy, you mentioned Greta Thunberg, and I'm going to take a risk here. I'm not criticizing the young lady, but let's just look at what young people are thinking. I mean, is it heresy, or at least very unpopular for me to ask of one so young, can she really be so wise? Are her simple solutions practicable? Perhaps she is the modern-day personification of the little boy in Hans Christian Andersen's Emperor's New Clothes. Does Greta see all of us for what we really are, naked? Or could it be that the young are not fully informed of the complexities of the issues, not misinformed, but rather ill-informed? That they're not in touch with the realities, for example, of energy and energy production? Do they have a rounded picture of these complicated issues? And this is more important, whose responsibility is it to teach the young on these issues? Surely ours, it's our responsibility, the grown-ups in the room. But what do you say to that?
Well, I think I'm going to quote Greta, who said, don't listen to me, listen to the scientists.
Okay.
And I do think that young people are much better informed than we are, Michael, because they are at school at a time where the science is so much more advanced and they're being taught.
And the access these to information.
The access to information, sure. Absolutely. So when I look at some of the brilliant youth that we work with, and we actually have seven students with us here at the ILA conference, at the International Leadership Association conference, who are all sustainability students. And so for me, working with them and working with others like Shie Bastida, who's both a youth and an Indigenous leader, these young people give me hope because they are very well informed and they understand that we actually have the technology, we have the ability to transform, we need the political will. And the other sector, as well as youth, that is inspiring me right now is the business sector.
That's important. That's important.
Yes, yep. And you would have heard Larry Fink from BlackRock come out and say, we need to be changing our modus operandi in the United States from a focus on simply shareholders to a focus on broader stakeholders. And you may be familiar with the recent Exxon board maneuver by One Engine, where people are stepping up and saying, we really need just transitions. And if boards are not going to do the right thing, then we need to make sure that we help them do the right thing. So people are saying there were board meetings before Exxon and One Engine and after. So I think there's a lot of attention now in the corporate world, not only to Larry Fink, but also to seeing how stakeholders are becoming activists and getting engaged. And I would just finish with a statement that Larry Fink made just this year. Climate is a material issue for boards, and that is why Mark Carney, the former governor of the Bank of England, has been so engaged with what people call the acronym TCFD, the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, i.e. stranded assets, i.e. your insurance liabilities. And we've seen Shell just recently taken to court in the Netherlands, and we've seen the young people in Australia go to court, take the environment minister to court and say, you cannot start a new coal-fired power plant and say that you are meeting your obligations to us as future citizens. So I personally am a huge fan of youth. I think they're standing up for their rights and they understand the science better than anyone. And that's why we need their voices to be louder even than they are now.
So well said. Good point. Youth. Good points. Good points. I'm not against youth at all. But listen, you're working for a fabulously rich billionaires, Julie Ann Wrigley, heiress to the chewing gum fortune, who is doing good things, so you told me, with her money. Please tell me about her. What are you doing with her and for her?
Julie is an absolutely extraordinary leader. And she really changed my life. We met by chance when I was on sabbatical from the New Zealand Foreign Ministry at the East-West Centre in Honolulu, Hawaii. And it's actually where I first met my husband way back in the 1980s when we both had scholarships there. I was learning Japanese, he was learning Chinese. And it was the conference of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, headquartered here, as you know, in Glan. And Inge Anderson, who had been a colleague at the World Bank, was running the IUCN. And we had a number of meetings with the East-West philanthropists. So Chinese and US billionaires committed to environmental stewardship and sustainability. So it was there that I met Julie and was so impressed by her personal story. She grew up in California, and she's a real visionary. So from a very early age, she started noticing the extra air pollution over Catalina Island. She started noticing the abalone, we call them pawa in New Zealand, the abalone shells changing on the beach. And so went to Stanford, studied law, became an environmental lawyer, was really worried that things were not moving fast enough. And in fact, she wanted to give her first donation of $100 million to Stanford University. But she had a quid pro quo, and that quid pro quo was because she saw youth as really having a multiplier impact, a positive multiplier impact in business, in government, and in the nonprofit world. And so she wanted Stanford to introduce a sustainability competency for every student. And Stanford said no. And at the same time, she met Michael Crow, who is also an extraordinary visionary. And he was leaving Columbia University, where he'd been very engaged with the Earth Institute, along with my boss, Peter Schlosser. And Michael said, well, I think it's a fabulous idea. Let's do it. And so between them, they created this first Global Institute of Sustainability and the School of Sustainability. And what I love about it is that they are such collaborative leaders. And so they've helped hundreds of other institutes and schools with open source material on how you do this.
Okay, fascinating.
And, yeah, I could talk forever about Julie. Sure. I'm her biggest fan.
Last question, Amanda. You've had years of experience. It's a practical question. You had years of experience in diplomacy, working with politicians of all colours, political stripes. So please give me and our listeners some insights into the realities. I nearly said difficulties. The realities of communicating complex and urgent messages, like, for example, on climate change and sustainability, which take place over time, a long time, and are not the stuff that hits the news headlines regularly, and of communicating these messages to politicians and policymakers in democracies whose time horizon might be at best 4 to 5 years, or at worst 2 years. I'm thinking of the cycle of elections and re-elections in the United States Congress. How, in your experience, do you approach that and square a very challenging circle, these conflicts of time?
I think this is really the big question of our times. And there are four issues for me. First of all, we need to acknowledge that we are in an era of what Kellyanne Conway calls alternative facts. So that just says it all. And when we look at the Edelman Trust Barometer, we see that governments are actually at the bottom of that trust barometer post-COVID, and business paradoxically is at the top. For me, it is a question of the different echo chambers that we are seeing now, misinformation, disinformation, as you referenced earlier, and the dark side of technology. When you look at some of the big players like Facebook and how for financial gain, the amplification of messages. So people are just hearing their own messages reinforced and often having misinformation reinforced. So on the flip side of that, looking at education in its traditional sense and the role of transdisciplinary education, how is it that we can really come to understand this very complex world we live in and the interplay of both planetary and societal boundaries? It is a huge challenge. But I would finish on perhaps the role that trusted public voices like yours play, Michael. And I'm not just saying that to flatter you. It is actually really important that we have trusted public voices that can translate the science into everyday knowledge and into simple facts that we can all understand. And I think seeing projects like Project Drawdown, for example, or the new work of the Julianne Wrigley Global Futures Laboratory, where we have eminent groups of scientists, of political figures, of youth voices, of government figures, all coming together around the table to say, how do we tell this story? And I love, for example, the top 100 solutions to climate change that Project Drawdown has come up with. It's a very easy, readable list. And you can then understand, okay, here's what I can do as an individual. Here's what we need to do systemically as a business or at that intermediary level. And here's what we need to do on the global governance level. And with COP26 coming up, we really need to heed the words of Nigel Topping, who is the UN climate envoy from the UK for COP26. And he warns us that, in fact, the global economy will be 40% smaller by 2050 if we do not take action now. So this is a real wake-up call for us to be getting this message out, to be supporting the Fridays for Future movement, the youth movement, and to be having our scientists continue to try to communicate in ways that work for parliamentarians like the Interparliamentary Union. You and I were with Martin Chungung last night, and climate is now number one issue for the Interparliamentary Union. So I have said we will work with them, and Michael, we need you involved too, to make sure that we actually translate into very short, actionable videos and modules climate education for parliamentarians who are going to be creating the laws
critically important
that change.
Yeah. Amanda, thanks a million for spending time with me and our listeners and for your invaluable insights, and we wish you continued success. Come back to Geneva again. See you soon. My guest today has been Ambassador Amanda Ellis of the ASU Julie Ann Wrigley Global Futures Laboratory, that's Arizona State University, and formerly New Zealand's permanent representative to the United Nations here in Geneva. Thank you again, Amanda.
Thank you so much, Michael. Such a pleasure to be with you again.
That was The McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.